Good morning. We have a full house today. That's wonderful. And we'll need all your cooperation to have this be a great panel. Your part is to make sure your phone is turned off, even if you're sure. Nothing interrupts a panel more than that rogue phone call. So thank you. If you'll check that, that would be great. Let's see. Also, for those of you who this may be your first panel, we do have a Conference on World Affairs app that you can download to your phone, and you can ask questions through that. We also will have producers walking around with note cards, so if you have a question you'd like to ask the panel, please just raise your hand, and they will bring you a note card. All right, well, let's get started. Good morning. Today is Wednesday, April 12th. It's 11 a.m., and this is panel number 3315. Watchdogs, Whistleblowers, and WikiLeaks. My name is Hillary Hall, and I have the privilege of serving as your Boulder County Clerk and Recorder. Thank you. I personally am very interested in this topic, as you can imagine. We have a wide range of watchdog organizations that have a keen interest in elections, so I'm hoping to pick up some new information and perhaps new approaches of how we work better together. We'll see. So I'm going to introduce the panelists as they speak. So our first panelist will be Karuna Jaeger, and she is the executive director of Breast Cancer Action, a national education and activist nonprofit organization working to achieve health justice for all women at risk and living with breast cancer. And she's based in San Francisco. And she's going to talk about why we have a need for a watchdog organization in the breast cancer world. And I think we can apply that probably to some other organizations as well. So, great. Take it away.
Oh, thank you so much. It's great to be here. So those of you who have been to these CWA conferences know that they put panelists on a range of panels, all kinds of topics, and there's always at least one oddball. My oddball is going to be tomorrow with Joe, Sex and Robots, and...
Right, the full panel title is What's Not to Love?
And I'm going to kick it off talking about my dogs, even though I promise this is not my oddball topic, my oddball panel. So I really am a dog person. I love dogs. I had my own dog that was not a family dog since I was 12. I took the dog to Germany, worked in Germany. I took the dog to college. I've really always been a dog owner. And my first dog never, ever, ever barked. I mean, she lived till 14 years. I really don't think I ever heard this dog bark. My second dog is a rescue from the streets of Oakland where I was living, where I was in grad school at Berkeley. He barked at everything. The other dogs taught him to do that. Bark, 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 bark. And, you know, you don't pay a dog like that any attention. My third dog, my current dog, is a shepherd mix. And he barks judiciously. And he's calling for help. And I feel like people say you look like your dog. Well, I have a dog that reflects the kind of work that I do. We bark judiciously, and we bring others on board. We are not like most other breast cancer organizations. We don't fall for the trap that the postal carrier is the big danger. You know, if you could just bark at the postal carrier, a mammogram will save your life. You know, we don't fall for the simple answer and the thing that's in front of you. We look for what's missing. We look for the silences. We look for the outliers. And we really look at what's really going on and why we have a breast cancer epidemic. We define ourselves as a watchdog mainly because of our conflict of interest policy. I think breast cancer is a hormone-driven disease. Treatments for breast cancer are part of the hormone system. You know, I went to the CEO and said, we need to stop. We need to recall this product. It's the pinnacle of hypocrisy to be asking people to buy this perfume, exposing themselves and their loved ones to these chemicals in the name of breast cancer. And so this is what we call the cancer industry. You know, it's when the companies that are producing chemicals, which are driving the epidemic, are working hand in hand with nonprofits, which are giving them cover, and companies which are producing cures, and it makes a very nice, tidy sort of profit cycle. The realities, you know, what it means is that the mainstream breast cancer movement is really distracting from the real issues, and it's selling simple stories with simple solutions to sell paid products and ask us all not to ask hard questions and challenge the status quo. I'm going to leave it with that. I'll say one more thing, which is that we are feminist health organization, and so we are, I would say, soft on the people and hard on the systems. And so the watchdogging is for the systems, and the compassion is for the people who are navigating the system.
Great. Thank you. Our next speaker is Gabrielle Appleby. She's the Research Director of Impact and Engagement at the University of New South Wales Faculty of Law. And she will be talking about public sector whistleblowers and is there a need for protection, their protection, or maybe not?
Thank you. So I'm going to start my talk by saying that, you know, whistleblowers are the people that know stuff, right? They're the people inside the organizations who are privy to the information, to the evidence about potential wrongdoing within those organizations. You can have as many externally established watchdog bodies as you want, whether they be government bodies, private bodies, legislative bodies, judicial bodies, but if they don't know what they need to be investigating or overseeing, they're not going to be able to fulfill their function. So whistleblowers are really fundamental to accountability. But whistleblowers are also incredibly vulnerable, right? There is a huge weight of reasons as someone inside an organization who knows something as to why you wouldn't go and blow the whistle on that. In Australia, which is where I'm from, in 2009, our Australian Law Reform Commission did a survey and looked at all of the federal laws that contained secrecy provisions that would prevent a whistleblower coming forward. And they found 506 secrecy provisions in the national legislation alone. 70% of those secrecy provisions were criminal sanctioned, and 75% of those were indictable offences, so serious offences. In Australia, the most notorious of those provisions is Section 70 of the Crimes Act, which every public servant knows about. It's a criminal offence. It carries a 2-year jail sentence. And it makes it a criminal offence to publish any information you've obtained in the course of your government employment. And it's not something that just sits on the statute books. We have had prosecutions in Australia for public servants who have blown the whistle. One of the most famous is a fellow by the name of Alan Kessing, who went to The Australian, a newspaper outlet, after he conducted a report on Australian airport security, and he found a number of serious lapses that was facilitating drug trafficking and illegal immigration, and the government wouldn't act on the report. He kept trying to get the government departments to respond, and eventually, at the point of exasperation, he went to an external journalist, and he was prosecuted and spent time in prison for that action under Section 70 of the Crimes Act. So, as you can hear, I'm very sympathetic to the whistleblower, and I think they're incredibly important. But I also think that government needs to keep secrets, right? I think that there are legitimate reasons that government needs to keep some information secret. There are the obvious national security reasons. The government can't have information about the raid on the potential terrorist headquarters tomorrow on the front paper, the front page of the paper today. There are legitimate public safety concerns, people in witness protection, police officers who are undercover. There are foreign relation concerns as to why you might want to keep information secret. Some of them are legitimate, some of them are just sort of bogus embarrassment claims, but some of them are legitimate. And I'm also persuaded that governments need secrecy in order to make good decisions. And this is perhaps a little bit more controversial. But I do think that in order to have government deliberate robustly, frankly, about really complicated issues, there needs to be some sort of protection in relation to the advice that they're given, to the debates that they have. And so I do accept that there is this need for government secrecy. And I also am very persuaded by the arguments of the UK philosopher Onara O'Neill, And for those of you who haven't heard Onara O'Neill's TED Talk or even her Wreath Lectures, I highly recommend them to you. They're on accountability and trust. And she makes the point that sometimes we do damage to government's ability to govern, which is really important, if we go too hard on the accountability and the transparency angle. And she's just got this quote that I just think really speaks to this point. She says, "Plants don't flourish when we pull them up too often to check how their roots are growing." So I'm totally conflicted about this issue. Yeah, I say I see the importance of whistleblowing. I see their vulnerability and their need for assistance and protection and perhaps incentives. But I also see the legitimate concern of government to keep some information secret and to limit transparency. So there's a tension, and I feel this tension very strongly, which I think means there's never going to be a perfect solution as to how you create some sort of regulatory framework or incentive or protection framework for whistleblowers. Now, some people have asked whether any sort of regulatory framework would ever be sufficient to protect whistleblowers and would ever be sufficient to protect against abuse of such a framework by whistleblowers who may be acting for less than legitimate reasons. Maybe they're pushing a personal vendetta, maybe they're pushing a partisan political agenda, for example. So there is an academic by the name of Raoul Sager, and he's published a book called Secrets and Leaks. And he makes an interesting point. He's like me. He thinks that whistleblowers perform a really important function, but he also thinks that potential protections for whistleblowers can be abused and you can lose necessary government secrecy. So he says, I don't think we should protect whistleblowers. Yeah. I think instead what we just have to rely upon is morally upstanding individuals to make judgment calls and break the law, and bear the burden of that, right? So he sort of puts the weight entirely on the whistleblower. And he develops five criteria for when he thinks it's appropriate for a whistleblower to act in breach of the law. He says that the whistleblower must have personally observed wrongdoing. He says there must be some sort of evidence, some clear evidence of that wrongdoing. He said the wrongdoing must pose a threat to public safety, which is a pretty high bar, as opposed to just us being concerned about being surveilled by the government. He actually says there needs to be a threat to public safety. There's no other option to combat that wrongdoing and that threat. And he also says that the individual needs to disclose their identity and take the full brunt of the repercussions of breaking the law. So there's no incentives, and there seems to be active discouragement in Sager's opinion, even though he thinks it's important. He thinks that this is where the balance needs to lie. Now, I disagree with this. I really disagree that we shouldn't and we can't provide protection for whistleblowers that is not going to be abused. I do think, ultimately, even if there is some sort of legal regulatory framework that's created, that we're still going to have to rely on the morally upstanding individual. So in that sense, I kind of agree with Sager. But I think that there should be a form of legislative regulatory protection that the individual whistleblower can take into account when they're making the decision as to whether or not they will blow the whistle. Now, I've done a lot of work with the Australian government about what should be protected under a whistleblower protection legislation, what shouldn't be protected, what's the sort of the bar, the threshold. And obviously there's a balance that needs to be struck there. I think that ultimately a regulatory framework will be the exposition of what the government thinks the balance should be, where the government thinks the balance should lie between protecting state secrecy and ensuring accountability and protecting whistleblowers. And I think that that's an important thing to be on the statute book. Right. But I also think that an individual whistleblower is still going to have to make a personal judgment call that will be informed by that regulatory framework but won't be dictated by that regulatory framework. So what do I mean by this? Well, they are going to be the ones who knows what the type of wrongdoing they have seen. they're going to be the ones who are going to have to evaluate whether or not repercussions that they're going to have will be sort of balanced against that level of wrongdoing. Even if they fall within the regulatory protections, there's still going to be reprisals against them. I think that we would be foolish to think that legislative regulatory protections prevent all forms of reprisals against whistleblowers. And so ultimately, even if it falls within the regulatory scheme, they may decide that they're not willing to take the risk. But they may also think that they've seen wrongdoing that wouldn't be protected by the government's regulatory scheme, and they think it is serious, and they are happy, or not, happy is the wrong word, they are willing to bear the consequences of that, and so they nonetheless blow the whistle even though it falls outside of the regulatory scheme. So the regulatory scheme, I think, is important. I don't agree with SAGAR that nothing should be offered to protect whistleblowers. I think they're too important for that. But I do agree with SAGAR that ultimately a system of whistleblowing is always going to rely on that individual judgment.
Thank you. Our final panelist is Joe Sexton. He is the senior editor for ProPublica. And for those of you not familiar, that's an independent nonprofit newsroom that produces investigative journalism in the public's interest. And I know this will come as a shock to you. He's going to bring some press perspective to the topic of whistleblowers. So thanks, Joe.
I'll try to be brief, in part because I think there are some real life, real-time examples that would make the basis of a good conversation, not only for us, but with you guys out there. You know, and I would just list them as, right, in the last year alone, we've had the Panama Papers, which was actually just awarded a Pulitzer Prize the other day, and presented its own distinct set of complications and challenges and moral questions for the journalists involved. We had WikiLeaks sort of water torture campaign against the Hillary Clinton campaign within the last, and again presented an interesting and difficult set of questions for journalists involved. And then we have the Trump dossier, which again presents its own distinctive set of questions for, you know, journalists and others to sort of work their way through in terms of how much, if anything, they want to make public. So it's nice when panels feel as topical, right? They can occasionally feel esoteric and, you know, distant or whatever. So I want to jump right into the sex with robots. I mean, in many ways, right, journalists, I mean, at ProPublica, we actually have a little thing on our homepage, Leak to Us, or at least it was called that before somebody then else suggested Leak on Us, which was Sean Spicer tried to do that, called us a lefty blog, but I think we won that pissing match to completely torture the metaphor. But anyway, I think fundamentally we love whistleblowers, and we love all kinds of whistleblowers. We like noble whistleblowers, we like crazy whistleblowers, we like, and the shocking percentage of whistleblowers are both noble and crazy, so we love them too. The question is, after we fall in love with them, kind of, you know, reverse engineering of relationships, we got to figure out just how much we like them. In terms of, you know, working our way through what is the accuracy of the material they want to offer us? What are the range of motives for them? And, you know, what are the conditions they want to place on our use of their information? Even when you work your way through that, and I think a couple of these examples give us a good real case for it, is you may not be able to settle all those issues. You may not be able to fully know the motives of the people
you're involving yourself with. To a full degree of, you know, certainty, you may not know the actual complete accuracy of what they are giving you. So those give rise to, you know, different kinds of calls and judgments. The Panama Papers, for instance, right? So one of the interesting, at least journalistic questions was the person who, you know, made that information available would not disclose who they were. And I think, I could be wrong and events may have unfolded, but at least when I met with some of the senior editors who were responsible for the Panama Papers and they made a nice presentation at ProPublica, they did not know then the identity of the person who had made the information possible. You know, that presents a real issue. I think they did a tremendous and wonderful job and responsible job of, you know, taking the information that they did have and reporting it out as thoroughly as they could. And they created a remarkable sort of worldwide newsroom in which, you know, they invited journalists from other countries because there were all sorts of people and institutions and politicians who were implicated in one way or another by the material in the Panama Papers. And they created a completely open newsroom where journalists had to share all of the information they were independently, you know, able to verify or advance. Nothing could be kept secret. They produced an enormously impressive body of work, the accuracy of which has not been meaningfully challenged. So they were able to sort of surmount the issue of what do you do if you can't and don't know the actual identity of the whistleblower. So in the WikiLeaks, example, and I had to be fully frank with you, I don't know how I come out on it to this day. I think you were there. You had an example of an organization that I think you could establish their motive pretty clearly, and yet the information the organization was releasing could be determined to be legitimately newsworthy. So could you, you know, where do you want to come out? Are you not going to report it because you think the motive is less than noble? And if the motive in this case was to damage Hillary Clinton's campaign, you could spin back in history and say, well, what would you have done with the Pentagon Papers when you were given that, which were clearly motivated by a person who, you know, had an antipathy against the country's presence in Vietnam. And a lot of, you know, right-minded people could think, you know, that was the right thing to do because they objected to the country's role in Vietnam. A lot of people who thought that, you know, was a treasonous act. But I think historically people will probably, you know, look fondly on the performance of journalists and the Pentagon Papers and the propriety of making them public. And then finally with the Trump dossier, there you had an instance in which the fundamental question was, the reporters who had been in possession of much of the material for weeks or months had been unable to confirm or verify much or any of it. Some of what they'd been able to report out actually turned out not to be right. But they explained themselves by saying, well, the dossier itself had been given by the intelligence community and the FBI, or a presentation on it had been made to the President of the United States, and that thus made it newsworthy. And the public had a right to know, well, okay, leaving aside the question of whether you were able to verify its accuracy, the intelligence agency of the United States thought it consequential enough to make a presentation to the president, even if that presentation were aimed at simply notifying him of his potential exposure to blackmail or, you know, other nefarious actors. And so BuzzFeed published it in full. And, you know, then other news organizations, as they are apt to do, think they've been spared the moral quandary and they'll just follow on. You know, we did not at ProPublica have access. We're not in possession of the dossier. So ultimately we're spared having to make that call. But I thought it would be a useful exercise to call everybody in our newsroom together and ask them and sort of go through the process. And so I took a poll. You could not have a secret ballot. The newsroom was split down the middle, which was its own sort of surprise. And the consequences of it, be interesting to see. There have been news accounts of late in which they've said that the FBI and others have actually confirmed some of the contents of the dossier. That may make BuzzFeed feel better. At the same time, there was a real risk to the people. You know, they named people people were named in the dossier who quite reasonably could have, regarded themselves as at risk as a consequence. I mean, you get jammed up in the world of Russian espionage, your life could be at peril. And I don't know how BuzzFeed feels about that. I think, and I could be wrong, I'm sorry, but you all can come up with your alternative facts. I think actually somebody has died in the interim who was named in the dossier. And the circumstances of it, I'm not sure, have been fully sorted out. But that's a pretty heavy thing as a news organization to sit with. So.
All right. Thank you. We'll take just a few minutes for you all to respond to what you've heard one another say. And whoever would like to start, please do. Or we'll jump right into some questions.
Well, I'm happy to. I love the sound of my own voice. But I'm curious on the question of the incentives, and I should have a better mastery of this than I don't. But our constitutional scholar from Australia probably does. They're just far better educated there. There are incentives for whistleblowers within the U.S. system. So if you are a whistleblower and you come forward and there is a federal action that results from it, and there are actual, monetary consequences of it, you get a cut of it. There are people who are whistleblowers who have been in receipt of, multi-million dollar payouts, which, again, you can have a variety of opinions about the health and worthiness of that. Does that recklessly incentivize them, or does it properly inspire people who might otherwise not have a reason to come forward to have one?
Yeah, I mean, the question of sort of the idea of bounties is a big one. So in Australia, there is quite substantial whistleblower protection in the states and at the national level, and none of them have this idea of incentive payments or bounties to incentivize whistleblowers to come forward. And the general feeling in our country is that that would provide a reckless incentive to bring people forward and potentially recklessly endanger state secrets, which properly need to be kept secret. But, you know, having spoken to a number of whistleblowers, it's not so much this idea that a bounty would actually incentivize them. They're far more concerned about protection from reprisals. You know, maybe a bounty would provide them compensation from those reprisals, but what they really want is protection from reprisals. That's the weight that bears down on them. And maybe the bounty can be justified that, you know, you can never actually create a regulatory framework that will protect against all reprisals, and I agree with that. I don't think you can ever stop people from treating other people a particular way in an organisation. And so maybe the bounty can be justified as compensation for the fact that there will always be reprisals. But so certainly in the Australian system, we've decided that's not where the balance lies. I don't know the statistics in the US system as to how the bounty system is operating, but it's, I think it's part of that debate about how much do you protect and incentivise.
Hey, I'm back. No, I was just, I'll just say one quick thing, which is, you know, and I just think it's important for people to keep in mind a sense of, you know, sort of historical context or whatever. And my gut instincts tell me that a fair number of people in this room are nostalgic for the Obama administration and who have reacted with a kind of horror at President Trump's, you know, claims about leaks and we should punish the leakers or whatever. You know, President Obama had a miserable record, at least from a journalist's point of view, on the question of whistleblowers and reprisals. He launched under his administration more leak investigations than any presidential administration before him. His administration across all agencies had a very poor record on basic freedom of information access. So, it's, you know, tempted as we might be to, you know, find a villain in the current president or whatever, we're obligated to take a bigger look at things because the record is mixed across all political parties and all administrations.
All right, thank you. So we have quite a few questions coming in. Again, if you have the app, feel free to upload a question. And if you have a question you'd like to ask and would like to do it with paper and pencil, just raise your hand and our producers will come around and give you those resources. All right, so let's see. Some of our first questions, so this for you, Karina, is regarding breast cancer, should we adopt screening guidelines which screen at less frequent intervals, much like Europe?
I love that somebody asked me about the mammography screening guidelines in the watchdog panel.
Yeah,
but I'm going to actually
group. I thought you
I'm going to start with. I'm going to give it a watchdog framework before I answer that question.
Probably should have.
So, in the 1980s. There was some early evidence that mammography screening could be beneficial, and women's health advocates and activists across the country started advocating to get coverage under Medicaid, and private insurers followed suit. And that was really seen as a really big win for preventive care. I want to, of course, say clearly that finding cancer early is not preventing cancer in the first place. And so it's always a frustration that screening falls under preventive care. As I said, we really do need to do real work around true primary prevention. But screening does work for some cancers. And the idea behind screening is that you take asymptomatic, healthy people at average risk. This is not people with BRCA mutations. This is not people who have already had cancer and may be at higher risk for recurrence. This is average risk people with no symptoms. And you screen them looking for early signs of disease in the hope that you can then change the natural course of the disease. And when it works, what happens is that you see that there's a shift. So if we say there's three groups, there's people who have not been diagnosed with cancer, people diagnosed with early stage, and people diagnosed with late stage. And when screening works, you shift those late-stage diagnoses to early stage. You're catching them early. The total number of diagnoses shouldn't change. What'll change is that you'll be catching them early. And that works in cervical cancer, for example, widespread pap smears, you know, it worked. Dramatic reduction in late stage cervical cancer. With breast cancer, what you see, and this was becoming clear in the 1990s, what you see is that the number of late stage diagnoses doesn't change. Instead, what's happening is we're moving people from that never diagnosed category into the category of an early diagnosis. And to understand this, we need to understand that breast cancer is really a complex disease that it's a single term that covers a lot, essentially a lot of different kinds of cancer that originate in the breast. Some are really aggressive, and basically it doesn't matter when they're caught, we don't have effective treatments. But some are really slow growing, and you know, it's generally said that breast cancer develops over decades, and the breast is not a vital organ. And so a slow-growing small tumor that stays in the breast and never spreads, and the woman will die of something else, that woman isn't benefiting when that thing is found and treated, right? It would never progress. It would never cause her problems over the course of her life. And so what's happening with breast cancer is we have 250,000 women diagnosed with breast cancer each year, and tens of thousands of those are estimated to be overdiagnosis, and then tens of thousands of women every year are subjected to the harms of overtreatment. And these are not, it's not a better safe than sorry world. You know, we've sort of been, the fear of breast cancer has been drummed into us in better safe than sorry. But, you know, no matter how long a woman lives after diagnosis, and I always say I hope it is a really, really long time, her body, her finances, sexual relationships, you know, there's a lifelong toll of this disease. And so the problem with mammography screening as it's been instituted in the U.S. is that it's seen as the answer, and in fact, it's not producing the promised results. Death rates have barely declined, and where they have declined, it's been the result of better treatment, not screening.
Thanks.
I can loop it back to the watchdog role. So why do you think it is that most breast cancer organizations promote mammography screening?
Yeah,
right. It was that cancer industry I was talking about.
Great. Thank you. So just if you're using the app and you're a student, please make sure you indicate that in your question, as you all remember that students' questions are asked first. And I have one here. It says, what kind of regulatory framework or approaches to extrasystematic leaking, i.e. WikiLeaks-style leaks, are the Australian government pursuing, if any?
I guess that question's for me.
Yeah.
and that would, no, yes.
Oh, I have
no
something
joke.
To say.
Yeah. So the Australian Parliament, so our federal parliament, has enacted what's called the Public Interest Disclosure Act, and it was kind of the last cab off the rank because the states had already enacted protections for whistleblowers, legislative protections for whistleblowers, and that had started in the 1990s, and the Public Interest Disclosure Act was about 2013, so it's relatively late. And so what's the type of regulatory framework are we talking about here? Well, really what they're trying to do is define for the potential whistleblower what the government thinks is the appropriate balance between providing sort of accountability through whistleblowers and maintaining appropriate secrecy for government information. So it does two things, really. It sets up a process for whistleblowers if they want to receive protection under the legislation, and when I say protection, it will be a defence against any criminal prosecution, so they won't be able to be prosecuted under Section 70 of the Crimes Act, and it will also be a defence against a civil action for breach of confidence, for example, and it will also be able to be used in any sort of employment situation if there are employment reprisals against the individual. So this is the type of protection the legislation provides. And the whistleblower can get that protection if they follow the process that the regulation sets out. Generally speaking, in all of the whistleblower laws in Australia, that process is leak internally first, right? So you go to supervisor, you escalate up to the person who might head your organisation. And even then, when they start talking about external leaking, they're talking about leaking to independent statutory agencies. They want you to leak first to the Ombudsman. They want you to leak first to, we have sort of standing anti-corruption commissions. They want you to leak to those. And really only in extreme circumstances would they allow and provide protection for a whistleblower to go to somewhere like WikiLeaks or to the media. So the example that I gave in relation to Alan Kessing, who was the official who leaked the report about airport security, he leaked before this regulatory regime was introduced. As I said, it was only 2013. But if he had done the same thing after the regime had been introduced, he still would have been prosecuted under Section 70 of the Crimes Act, because he didn't follow the process that the regulatory regime set out. He decided, he tried, and then he decided that the reprisals were coming thick and fast. He needed to go outside to a journalist and go external ASAP, and he bore the brunt of that decision. As I said, it will still rely on the individual. The other thing that the regulatory frameworks set out, which I find really difficult, is they try to define what types of situations would justify the leaking. And they use language like when it's in the public interest. So if you're a whistleblower and you're thinking, will I fall within the legislative protections if I pursue this process? That whistleblower has to make a judgment call about what's in the public interest and how the courts and the government's going to interpret that term as to whether or not they fall within that protection. And so I submitted very strongly when this legislation was going through Parliament that that wasn't great. That was hugely problematic. And that, in fact, it needs to be quite a clear regulatory regime as to what types of leaks will get protection and what types of leaks won't. And because I think that that then means that the individual whistleblower can make an informed decision about whether or not what they're going to do falls within the scheme or not, and whether or not they still want to do it. So that's the type of regulatory framework that I'm talking about from the Australian experience.
Great, thank you. And of course, what panel on WikiLeaks wouldn't be complete without questions about Snowden, Eric Snowden, Edward Snowden, sorry. So I'm going to ask them all together so that we can have that conversation all at one time. So some of the questions are, is Edward Snowden, sorry, a whistleblower or a traitor? Let's see. How should the U.S. government deal with Edward Snowden? And then we also have, you know, kind of talking about your stance on whistleblowers seems similar to Martin Luther King's view on breaking an unjust law. That being said, what is your stance on Edward Snowden, who then avoided any consequences based on the question? So whoever would like to start, and you there, however you'd like to use those questions, it's all the same topic. So we warmed you up.
Right. Well, it's an interesting, you know, this may be the ultimate, you know, cop-out. But let me see if I can sustain an argument, which is that it's actually not my position to say whether Edward Snowden is a traitor or a hero. My role, you know, or the journalist's role, is not to judge the whistleblower, but to make responsible choices about what the whistleblower has put in front of you. So, you know, if the question were you comfortable with what the news organizations did with the information that Edward Snowden, I think that'd be a question I'd be obligated to answer. And I think, by and large, they made the right judgment calls on that. And I think in every instance, gave the government certainly the opportunity, certainly the heads up that they were contemplating disclosing the material, the opportunity to make a case that they shouldn't for a variety of reasons, national security or otherwise, and went ahead and made those decisions. And I think by and large the history has proved those judgments to have been sound. So that'd be my point of view.
So I think that judging Edward Snowden actually is sort of ties in to my position on whistleblowers, in that I would agree with Joe, it's not really our place to judge Edward Snowden. I would take issue that he didn't suffer any consequences. He's suffering the full consequences of his actions. He can't return to the United States. But he did what he did knowing that he was going to suffer consequences. He did what he did having tried to talk to others in the organisation about his concerns about what was happening, and no one would listen to him. So he tried initially to talk to others, and he then did what I would say sort of has to be done, and we can disagree with how he did it, but he did for himself the balancing act between the competing interests, right? He was the one who knew what he'd seen. He knew that this was going to have repercussions. He knew that it would potentially endanger the whole surveillance scheme if he blew the whistle on it, and so that he would undermine a system that the American public maybe was perfectly happy with. But he weighed those issues. He made the judgment calls. He knew what the consequences, no, maybe not specifically, but he knew there were going to be serious consequences. And he decided that for him, his judgment meant he had to do what he did. And I think that's what we have to say if we believe that whistleblowers are important. That's what they need to do. We can disagree with whether he made the right balancing act, but whistleblowers, we ultimately rely on the individual making a judgment. It's going to be subjective. We're going to have different opinions about it. I think having read and listened to him speak about how he made that judgment, how he made that weighing, I think he did the right... He undertook the right exercise.
And it's worth, you know... Just a couple of things to note, right? One is he didn't go to WikiLeaks, so if people are under that misimpression. And he didn't go... to my alma mater, the New York Times, either. And I think I've got this right, but I think his explanation is that he didn't because he had felt they were not, trustworthy is not the right word, but so the New York Times had actually published, you know, a fair amount of information back in 2005, I think, on the NSA and its surveillance programs. But it had sat on the story for a year, in part, I think, because the government had expressed concerns about it, in part because they wanted to report it out more fully. And Snowden, I think, was disappointed in that performance. So when he went to a news organization, I think he consciously did not go to the Times and went to the Guardian and then ultimately to the Washington Post as well.
Related to that is around the importance of the whistleblower's identity. In the Panama Papers, the identity didn't come forward. The question, and to talk on that topic, is do you think Snowden would have still revealed his identity had the Panama Papers come to occurrence before his exercise? And then with that, what is the importance of of who is sending in the information and knowing the whistleblower?
I'm quite certain that Snowden, he knew he was going to be found out. He was never under any misimpression that he wasn't going to be identified and punished. I think he made the calculation, as was beautifully articulated, in full awareness of the consequences.
So, yeah, and then the importance of the identity of the whistleblower, is that... Again, because that could provide protection, but is that an important part of the process?
So anonymity is a big thing that comes up when I've spoken to whistleblowers, and certainly when the Australian government was sort of formulating its whistleblower protection legislation, whether or not to grant anonymity or to give protection for anonymity was a big issue. I think, and as I said, SAGA's position is that the whistleblower needs to reveal their identity. That needs to be part of the weighing, because it allows the external journalists to evaluate the credibility. It allows the public to evaluate the credibility, and so that's sort of a part of the balance. But certainly from the whistleblowers that I've spoken to, a number of them have just the fear of reprisal. Anonymity is basically, for many of them, a minimal condition. So I think if you do think that whistleblowers perform an important role and you go and speak to people who are thinking about blowing the whistle, what is the core things? I don't think it's the bounty. I think it's anonymity.
The just to, in the service of not having the conversation too dominated by I'm curious for our breast cancer watchdog. So one of the things that you talked about was you know, your willingness to call out the other nonprofits who are, have you actually experienced reprisal as a consequence? Have they tried to, you know, get at your funding or in some ways, you know, undermine your efforts?
So let me sort of, I want to kind of, yeah, two things. So
let's do both.
I'm here to fuck things up.
So. I mean, it's interesting thinking, I will answer, but thinking about this whistleblower question was interesting to me because for me, who's producing the research and who's funding the research absolutely does matter. Knowing where those conflict of interests lie, you know, the money and the power and following the money is so important. And, you know, researchers are supposed to disclose those conflicts of interest, and it helped us understand why different researchers reach different conclusions. So I'm sort of interested in this question of, like, where anonymity falls. As far as our relationships in the breast cancer world, you know, what I would say again is we are right on the evidence. You know, we came out early talking about the mammography screening evidence, and we are an outlier. We are not invited to the table many times, and I think having it, you can get comfortable with a seat at the table, and I think I'm really comfortable with our role being an organization that's kind of holding out for what we really need and what's right and making space for other organizations, you know, kind of pulling the field our way. We actually have had quite a bit of pushback from individuals, so we have had, when we take controversial stands, we seem to have a big hack attempt, and that actually was covered by our nonprofit insurance. We, one of our, this afternoon, I'm going to be on the Future of Medicine panel, and I'm going to talk about FDA drug approvals. Very quickly. Right now, FDA approves a lot of drugs using surrogate endpoints. So saying, here's some preliminary data that says cancer patients will live longer. Too often, that's not actually true. More often than not, that's not what happens. There was a breast cancer drug that was approved on an accelerated conditional approval that seemed promising, and subsequent data didn't pan out. It's really very toxic, and as many women were dying from the treatment as arguably lives were saved from the treatment. So this is not a drug that's appropriate for the general population. Perhaps there are some biomarkers. Perhaps there is a subpopulation that benefits. You are not going to find that subpopulation so long as this drug is approved for general use. FDA, this is the only cancer drug that was up for accelerated approval that FDA revoked. It's Avastin. They pulled that accelerated approval, and we spoke out on this. And so I had a board member out in D.C. who spoke out. She was attacked personally. She had to get escorted out the back door by Homeland Security. So it's not quite the same thing, but yes, we take controversial positions, and kind of shocking things happen. You know, she was, you know, people told her they wished she would die. You know, it's like pretty, and she, Homeland Security took her out the back door.
Thank you. Right. So a couple more student questions. One is, do you think we need more support for whistleblowers in case where government fails to create an independent third-party investigation? The example they give is the executive decision to bomb Syria, breaking international and constitutional law. So it says, do you think we need to support more support for whistleblowers in the case where government fails to create an independent third-party investigation? I guess you could also extrapolate on that, or what might that look like? enforce a third-party investigation?
I mean, I'm not sure the Syria example is a particularly useful one, but I would, I mean, my instinctive response would be, sure, if there are ways to imagine greater supports for people to come forward with vital information, you know, in a kind of general sense, that sounds perfectly righteous, but as our colleagues know, you know, it's going to be in the details of, you know, what those protections are and under what terms and at what costs.
Yeah, and I've certainly, I don't know the U.S. protections particularly well, but I know the Australian protections, and I don't think that any of the states' protections or the federal protections go far enough or are clear enough for whistleblowers. So, even in the absence of a sort of an example as to should we have more protections right now for this example, I think in Australia we need to do better in terms of protecting whistleblowers, and I've sort of continued to advocate for that.
Could I do an experiment?
Sure.
All right, so before too many more people leave, hey, come back. I'm sorry.
Part of our experiment.
Yeah. Okay, so here's the deal. We'll replicate the newsroom experiment. Okay, there's going to be reprisals. All right, you've been presented with a 35-page dossier on the newly elected President of the United States. It's full of salacious and tantalizing information. You haven't been able to actually confirm any of it, but you've been told that the President has been shown this dossier, and it is of such concern to the United States intelligence community that they have made that presentation to him. Do you publish it? Hands up. Do you not? All right. So I vote, you know, I voted in the newsroom and I'll vote here or whatever, and I was a not.
All right.
Oh, its existence. Well, you know, it's such a it's an interesting you know, it's an easy way out for some news organizations, and many were quick to sort of respond to it. You know, I think I would have kept it as general as possible, that there was a dossier that allegedly had some compromising information about the, and that's about it.
So along those same lines, we have a couple student questions that are related to the role of WikiLeaks and then also whistleblowers as another form of checks and balances, particularly for government. One of the students' questions also follows on to talk about Julian Assange as, you know, hero or criminal. Should he be forced to take responsibility for WikiLeaks' influence? So I just want to kind of lump those together of, like, what is the role of organizations like WikiLeaks, and how do, you know, how do you have advice for how do we as the public seeing that engage intelligently with the information that we see?
All right, I'm going to answer, and then in the spirit of leaking or whatever, I'm going to go take a leak. but I think, again, to not meaning to be glib, but I think, right, I mean, the theory of organizations like WikiLeaks, I think, is mostly virtuous. But it's all about the particular execution and the particular character of the people who are involved. So again, as a general proposition, the idea that you know, information that the world has a reasonable right to know and would be well served by knowing is a fundamentally sound one. You know, and the organizations that get involved in that, including ours, because in effect, that's what we do every day, will be judged on, you know, the responsibility and the accountability of the people who perform that.
Now you're leaving.
We'll be here. Come back.
So
we have a little bit longer.
I now that he's left, I agree with Joe. So I think that WikiLeaks or organisations like WikiLeaks, or, you know, The Guardian has now set up an anonymous Dropbox in a similar sort of form as WikiLeaks, are neither sort of good nor bad. It's how the judgment is exercised once the information is provided. So I think that this just reinforces. So I've been talking about judgment. I've been talking about the judgment of the whistleblower and how important that is. And then Joe's been talking about judgment, which is the importance of the judgment of those who receive the information from the whistleblower. Right? And so I think in terms of are organisations like WikiLeaks good or bad? Well, it depends on how well they exercise their judgment. And, you know, we may disagree with the decisions they ultimately make, but coming back to my theme, have they asked themselves the right questions? Have they weighed up the right sort of interests? And that there's never going to be the perfect answer that everybody agrees with in terms of whether to report and to disclose particular information. But have they just done it carte blanche because it's landed in their Dropbox? Or have they done it and exercised judgment? And if they're an organisation that does that responsibly, I think they can be a real form for good. I have questions about some of the judgment that's been exercised by WikiLeaks, and not just I disagree with their ultimate conclusion. That would just be we come to subjectively different judgment calls. But I have concerns about how the processes of WikiLeaks operate and how those judgments are formed. I have serious concerns about any organisation that becomes too closely associated with an individual. And so the Julian Assange's influence and association with WikiLeaks I find hugely problematic. I can't see that it can hold itself out as being an independent, non-partisan institution. And you know, I'm an Australian, and Assange is Australian. Assange, from the embassy in London, tried to field a number of candidates in the, it must have been the 2013 federal election in Australia. So he's in Australia, he's a huge personality. The WikiLeaks Party is what it was called in the Australian federal election. He was a candidate. He had a number of other candidates. It was alleged to be the most opaque, non-transparent, non-accountable party. Candidates left in droves and were not allowed to speak out against it. So there you go.
Wow. Would you go ahead and speak just around the role of watchdog organizations, especially as we proceed forward in this age of technology, and how do we, as the citizens, make our way through that information as well?
Yeah. I just have a pretty simple analysis, which is follow the money. Look at who's benefiting and follow the money. So again, going back to the breast cancer industry, I'll tell a story about how I can tell the story about the pink ribbon and about how the Breast Cancer Awareness Month came to be. I've told the pink ribbon story in other forums, so I'll start with Breast Cancer Awareness Month. It was created in 1985 by a partnership with a pharmaceutical company and the American Cancer Society. American Cancer Society's philosophy is about smoking cessation and screening. They are uninterested in environmental links to cancer. They've been just absolutely dragging their heels on evidence that is widely acknowledged and widely, widely accepted. I would argue that some of the larger cancer nonprofits are basically, you know, science deniers. I mean, I think there's examples of Susan G. Komen, you know, their own I was at conferences where, like, their own medical advisor is just casually acknowledging the known link between chemicals and breast cancer, and their website, you know, says this chemical is safe. BPA, DDT, DDS. You know, there's different chemicals that they, you know, and they take funding from pharmaceutical companies. They take funding from, you know, you look at the BPA example, they're getting funding from Coca-Cola and from General Mills. You know, who's holding the purse strings, and what's that organization saying? So I got off of my Breast Cancer Awareness Month thing. So anyway, Breast Cancer Awareness Month started by American Cancer Society and what's now AstraZeneca. AstraZeneca makes the most common breast cancer treatment, tamoxifen. They're even trying to use tamoxifen in women who don't have cancer. They call it chemo prevention. So basically the idea is you give healthy women chemotherapy to reduce the risk of breast cancer so they don't have to take chemotherapy. And I was, when I first came to Breast Cancer Action, you know, one of the very, just in my first weeks on the job, one of the very first studies that came through that I was evaluating. So what we do is we basically translate the science, democratize it, and we view our job really as giving women unbiased information so they can make the decision that's right for them. There is no single right answer. It's up to each person to navigate the evidence and come up with a decision. You know, as you say, it's a judgment call. You know, each person has a right to the full balance of evidence, because even Tylenol comes with harm and benefit, aspirin comes with harm and benefit. We need to have the balance of information and then weigh that for ourselves based on our values and priorities. It is our body after all. Wow, I have a lot of rabbit holes. AstraZeneca makes tamoxifen. This one study, they said they defined high risk as a woman aged 60 or over. So they basically pathologized aging, right? That's truly the cancer industry. You take something and you expand your market. Now you're giving women without cancer drugs to reduce the risk of cancer. So anyway, American Cancer Society and AstraZeneca partnered up to develop Breast Cancer Awareness Month, which is about awareness and screening. And we've already talked about screening and the limits of screening and the failures of screening. And they have just been dragging their feet on the evidence that's been very clear since the 90s. Again, you know, we've had a lot of pushback on this. People think that, you know, it's personal, right? And if you believe that screening is going to save your life, you know, we get personally attacked for some people feel for trivializing, what they feel is a life-saving procedure. I mean, how many women say my mammogram cost me my breast unnecessarily? You know, it's an uncomfortable, truth. So we have been calling Breast Cancer Awareness Month Breast Cancer Industry Month for a number of years to call out the number of companies that have jumped on the pink bandwagon and are making billions of dollars in the name of breast cancer, and we just have too little to show for it.
Thank you. All right, we have another, go ahead, Ms. Blue. Feel the urge. Let's see, we have another student question. What do you think the significance is that of contractors playing in whistleblowing? Obviously, the most famous is Edward Snowden, and it's kind of that contractors, and especially as we contract more and more in our government and national security arenas.
Excellent question. So it goes back to the sort of the crux of it, which is government's privatization of government services, right? So I started by saying whistleblowers know stuff. They're important. They're the ones who know stuff. And if government is increasingly contracting out its services or getting contracts in to assist with the services that it is providing, we're now in the situation where the whistleblowers may be working for the contractors, and they're still in the position of that they know stuff. We in Australia, I'm sure it's the same in the US, but privatisation has just gone mad. We have privatisation of prisons. We have privatisation. I'm going to be speaking tomorrow about our asylum seeker policy, our refugee policy, and the detention centres in which we keep refugees are run by private contractors, and very often we can't get our hands on the contracts and the terms of those contractors. So, I mean, privatisation in and of itself is a huge problem. And one of the problems is that the traditional accountability mechanisms often haven't evolved fast enough with this phenomenon of privatisation, and so we can't use them to get at the contractors. And so what we're doing in Australia is every time there's a review of our ombudsman legislation or our freedom of information legislation, academics in particular, or concerned citizens, are desperately pleading these jurisdictions need to start to extend to contractors. Yeah, it's not just enough to be overseeing government public servants, strictly speaking. They need to have an extended jurisdiction. And I'm very happy to say that because the federal whistleblower legislation was so late off the mark, it has learnt this lesson. And in Australia, the federal whistleblower legislation does extend to people who have been working for contractors to the federal government. And hopefully what we're seeing there is part of a trend that other legislation will be amended to keep up with that that trend as well.
Just a couple, well, we have quite a few more, but we're not going to get to them all. I'm trying to ask those at the high general level. Can you think of one case where whistleblowers have actually created more harm than benefit? I think that is one of the crux of it. Several on that topic.
I'm sure there are examples. I have no doubt of it. I mean, one, but maybe I'll make this modest contribution. There have been examples where whistleblowers have been wrong, and either as a consequence of, you know, their own misunderstanding of stuff, or with a kind of intentional purpose to mislead. One of the fascinating questions for journalists to wrestle with is, so, you know, a whistleblower can come forward, contact you. You extend a promise of anonymity and confidentiality based on, you know, a good faith agreement. And then the material turns out to be wrong. What is your remaining obligation to your whistleblower in terms of the confidentiality and anonymity arrangement you've worked out? This played out, and again, I won't get the precise details, but it was a multi-year-long nightmare at the New York Times. But Judith Miller was a reporter who had done a bunch of reporting on both the sort of possible presence of WMDs in Iraq, and that did not work out well, but also had entered into a relationship with an official in the Bush administration, and ultimately turned out that person had lied to her, but she had granted that person confidentiality. She wound up going to jail as a consequence because she would not identify her source. It's a fascinating thing to wrestle with. If you have been abused, in effect, by your confidential source, what is your obligation? I'm not sure I've entirely settled it in my own head. It's one of those fascinating things that when you get into the actual particulars of these real life examples can happen.
So not to answer that, but to add to that, in thinking about this panel, I did a rare moment of you taught me this, Google. So I took 5 minutes, and I found this quote from Dan Rather that I think is provocative and interesting and relates very much to what you're saying. The press, journalistic side, and I think it's different for us. I'll read the quote. "The press is a watchdog, not an attack dog. Not a lapdog like our friend up here. A watchdog. Now, a watchdog can't be right all the time. He doesn't bark only when he sees or smells something that's dangerous. A good watchdog barks at things that are suspicious." I find that really provocative. And I think for me, running a watchdog organization, I need to know the evidence is right. And that's really a bar for us.
Right. And, you know, Dan's speaking from some painful experience, right?
Yes.
And yet, there have been movies made about that debacle or whatever, but I got to say I'm pretty sympathetic with Dan and his team. I mean, they did quite a bit of due diligence on this. Was a story involving George W. Bush's military service. And maybe that's what he's getting at. And not only will watchdogs not always be right, or whistleblowers not always be right. The question is, journalism is a fundamentally sort of lunatic proposition, which is like the New York Times publishes 100,000 words a day, whatever, just in its print newspaper.
And this, and you know, and God, I love the people there. I gave 25 years of my life to the organization. It's a big, beautiful, flawed, you know, wonderful, dysfunctional, enraging, inspiring institution. But the idea that, like, you know, you're going to get 100,000 words out a day, every day, 7 days a week, 12 months a year, 100 years, and be right? I mean, come on. It's just not a sustainable human endeavor. So it comes down to being honest about what you get right and what you don't. And I think they've been pretty good about that historically. But, you know, as we go into this, you know, ever more charged environment of combat and contest over what's real and what's truth and what are facts and what are not, you know, I've got to give a talk on Saturday to some journalism students, whatever, and they want to know, you know, what do we do now? And my answer, and it's not actually a really great fucking rallying cry, but, like, stay humble. It's good advice, right? Do what you can. Admit your mistakes. You know, be stubborn and persistent and transparent. Stay humble.
Thank you. All right. Well, let's thank our panel. Appreciate you all sharing your words of wisdom. And thank you. And enjoy the rest of your week here. And thank you all for coming and joining us for this panel. Another big hand.